From Pacifica Now, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at President Clinton's day before Kenneth Starr's grand jury. Also, driving while black. A black police officer convicted of resisting arrest during a traffic stop files a federal civil rights lawsuit against the Florida Sheriff's Office. He says he was pulled over because of his race. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, as Amy Goodman would say, the exception to the rulers. Amy's on assignment. Sitting in for her today, I'm Laura Flanders. Police have arrested five people in connection with the bombing in Omagh Saturday, a small Irish Republican group, though, which has been linked to the guerrillas accused of carrying out the blast, denied it had anything to do with it. The bomb killed at least 28 people this weekend. The Committee for 32-County Sovereignty denied widespread suggestions that it was the political wing of the dissident Republican, quote, real IRA, unquote, and they blamed by the police and the Irish Prime Minister for the blast over the weekend. No organization, in fact, has claimed responsibility for the attack, which was the worst in Northern Ireland for 30 years. Iraq will respond today, Monday, to a message from UN Secretary General Kofi Annan calling on Baghdad to resume cooperation with UN weapons inspectors, a diplomat has said. A UN spokesman said earlier on Monday that a UN special envoy in Iraq had sent a report to Annan on his talks in Baghdad to try to resolve a standoff between Iraq and the UN weapons inspectors. Annan's special envoy arrived in Iraq on Thursday carrying a firm message from Annan that Baghdad should resume cooperation with the UN weapons inspectors, which it suspended earlier this month. Western diplomats based in Baghdad said that the UN Security Council was expected to meet on Monday to discuss the impasse. Kenyan and American investigators are probing the deadly bombings of two U.S. embassies in East Africa, but they're remaining silent today on the whereabouts of a key suspect extradited from Pakistan. Pakistan's foreign ministry said on Sunday that the man known as Mohammed Sadiq Hawida had been arrested in Karachi on August 7th, the day of the bombings, on arrival from Nairobi. The Pakistani authorities said he had been interrogated and sent back to Nairobi for further questioning, but Kenyan and U.S. officials refused even to acknowledge his presence in East Africa. At least 258 people were killed and over 5,000 injured in simultaneous car bomb attacks on the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam on August 7th. Some 34,000 unionized phone workers have begun a strike against U.S. West. The strike by the Communications Workers of America began at 2 a.m. Eastern Time after 2 days of intense secret negotiations on a new labor agreement. The big sticking point, a controversial performance pay plan which the union opposes. U.S. West provides phone service to 25 million customers in 14 Western states. The company says customers can expect some delays in repairs, installation, and directory assistance calls, but there should be little effect on automated phone services. In just a few hours, for those of you who have been asleep for the last few weeks, President Clinton will begin what some consider to be the defining moment of his presidency. Fancy that. Clinton and his lawyers will enter the White House map room to answer questions for a grand jury investigating the Monica Lewinsky matter. Advisers say Clinton will probably admit to an improper relationship, quote-unquote, with the former White House intern, which is a switch from previous denials. No decision has been made yet on whether the president will speak to the nation afterwards. Aides are believed to be urging him to make a short speech tonight. Former White House Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers says Clinton has to be what she calls brutally honest with both prosecutors and the American people. Interviewed this morning on NBC, Myers said the president can't try to, quote, wiggle out of this. The 19-year-old Hamilton woman arrived at Newark International Airport around 1:20 a.m. today, greeted by friends and families. That's Michelle Keegan of New Jersey, who says she has no regrets about standing up for human rights in Burma, where she and others were detained and eventually deported. Keegan says, "It feels absolutely incredible to be home." She was among 18 activists from many countries detained by Burma's military dictators for distributing pro-democracy greeting cards. They were tried and sentenced to 5 years of hard labor Friday, then deported the very next day. Keegan flew into Newark from Los Angeles, the last leg in a day-long series of flights with fellow activist Anne Jeanette Hamilton of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who's away on assignment. I'm Laura Flanders. Well, today President Clinton is scheduled to testify in front of the grand jury investigating the Monica Lewinsky matter. His testimony is expected to get underway early this afternoon. The president will be speaking to the grand jury from the White House via closed-circuit television. At issue is whether or not Clinton committed perjury when he gave a sworn deposition to the Paula Jones grand jury that he did not have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, the former White House intern. Clinton is also accused of encouraging Lewinsky to lie under oath about the nature of the relationship. Many news reports over the weekend have said that Clinton will admit some kind of inappropriate sexual conduct with Lewinsky, but will insist that he didn't tell her to lie about it under oath, or may even dispute exactly what sexual relations means. Well, with us to try to make sense of some of this is a distinguished fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of Visions and Revisions, Reflections on Culture and Democracy at the End of the Century. His name is Mark Raskin. Mark, I'd like to welcome you to Democracy Now! We hear a lot, we've been hearing a lot, we will hear a lot for the rest of the day, I'm sure, about the implications of this testimony for the president, for Bill Clinton, sometimes for his wife, for his child, but most often for that one individual, as is so often in news stories in this country. We're seeing the whole political process played out as a kind of play, a stage play with one main actor, and that main actor is the president. I'd like to ask you, we're hearing the implications for him. What about the implications for us, the American people, the electorate, the system? What is this doing to us?
Well, I think it's doing several things. First of all, the office itself, that is the prestige of the presidency, is being shrunk. Now, this continues a trend which began with the end of the Indochina War and the resignation of Nixon under a cloud during the Watergate hearings. While that moment came, I suppose, as a profound tragedy, the present is act two of the same tragedy, but it is more in the form of a farce. But nevertheless, it results in the shrinkage of executive power. What I mean by this is that in a time of relative calm, the federal system in the United States allows for power to move back to the states. Now, what this means is that, as Clinton put it several years ago, big government is over. And being from the South and the Southern governor, he keeps pressing for states' rights. The result of the pressing for states' rights means that the power of the president to develop a national direction on public policy is much less, where in effect the country itself then moves back to a position prior to the Second World War, that is, prior to the point where executive power was very great. This, of course, comes at a very peculiar time in American history, where what we've attempted to do is develop national standards with regard to civil rights, with regard to welfare, etc. Instead, now what we're going to see is, as a result of the Clinton presidency and as a result of the sex scandal, the direction that was taken over the course of this last decade or so will be greatly increased to the weakening the federal government as a result of the scandal.
Mark Raskin, one question pertaining to that. We saw over the weekend in the Washington Post and a few other places criticism of the investigation and of the president's involvement in this scandal from those who said this was distracting him from his international agenda, and they looked at the situation in Iraq, that situation in Kosovo. Now, there are obviously people that say, thank heavens the president is distracted from his agenda, but what do you make of that criticism, which is getting at certainly some sort of executive role that people still hold out for the presidency?
Well, I think there's no question that the White House staff is demoralized at this point, and the government itself is now treading water. That is to say that no great decisions or small ones particularly are being made at this moment, that everything is waiting for his statement today, for what will play out over the course of the next few weeks. Now, with regard to that, the Republican Party has an interest in just letting this scandal play out in such a way that it will hurt the Democratic Party. It will also cause people to say, well, let's now have a real investigation of the 1996 campaign in terms of the financing of the 1996 campaign. So depending on what happens now over the course of the next few weeks, there may be another independent counsel chosen by the Attorney General if the president does badly over the next couple weeks. That then will pretty much finish his presidency.
So just to recap, what you're saying here is that there is a connection between the type of politics that we've seen in the Clinton era so far, coming most of it from the Capitol, from the Congress and the Senate, that has been advocating a rollback of federal power at the state level, whether it had to do with welfare or health care or education, that is in some way connected. There's a continuum connecting that and this investigation. The investigation sometimes seems to be the crusade of one individual, but it certainly wouldn't be the first time that a morality crusade was a cover for something more.
That's exactly right. This is a morality crusade on one level, but what's involved is a profound change in the power structure or the power relationships in the federal system, which developed during the President Roosevelt's era, and which, in fact, sustained the American government for a 50-year period during war and Cold War. And so Clinton, in that sense, is finishing off that period of national power. And what this means is another thing that's very important to look at. This will greatly increase the power of international corporations, who will not be able to be controlled through a states' rights system within this country. Now, what's interesting about this is that the Democratic Party, really beginning with Woodrow Wilson, had a national export strategy. But at the same time, Wilson believed in the control over the corporations to some extent. In this case, in Clinton's case, there's been virtually no control over corporations. He's pressed very hard for a national export strategy. At the same time, favoring a states' rights strategy, which the Republicans and Southern Democrats want very much. The result of this will be, as I suggested, very great power now moving to the international corporations, which will basically be unaccountable at the state level, and because of weaknesses in state legislatures, etc.
We're talking with Mark Raskin, a distinguished fellow at IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. One last question, Mark, before we have to let you go. All of this sounds very dire. If people were feeling discouraged, disillusioned before, I doubt that your presentation this morning is going to make them feel more cheered. What about the prospects for the elections this fall? Are people just going to sit on their hands in disgust? What should they do?
Well, I think that that again depends on what the next few weeks brings. I think that here is where the sexual scandal aspects begin playing a part. Everyone, in one way or another, seems to believe that sex is a matter to lie about, and that anyone can, in fact, find himself or herself in trouble, in prosecutorial trouble, if a particular prosecutor wants to go after somebody on sexual matters. And so I think the people in the country weigh a lie around sex against the harm that can result, especially in the hands of a criminal prosecution, where a truth is used in the hands of that prosecution for utterly destructive purposes.
Mm.
And I think that's what's going on here. The American people intuit about this entire affair, namely that the harm done to the country by forcing a truth will be greater than any punishment which could result from a particular mistruth or lie.
Well, clearly we could continue this conversation for a lot longer, but Mark Raskin from Washington, D.C., thanks for being with us here on Pacifica's Democracy Now! Our next participant is Judith Sloan, who is a comedian and a performer, and who better, really, to talk to today on this day where the president's performance is, well, shall we say, up for grabs, is certainly a matter of dispute. Sex and law both seem to be about performance, so who better to go to than Judith? What advice would you give the president today, Judith Sloan?
Well, you know, Laura, since the media has been taken over by entertainment corporations and it's all about entertainment, this is going to come as a complete surprise to the Washington Press Corps and I'm sure to you and everybody else. My husband and I are actually very close to the president, and one idea that's been floated, one strategy, is that Clinton will come out and apologize for firing Jocelyn Elders. Now, for those listeners that don't remember Jocelyn Elders and questions about AIDS and safe sex, she mentioned teaching masturbation. And so Clinton, you know, said, get out of here with that nasty talk, and I don't want to hear any of that. And now he's going to bring Jocelyn Elders back and finally is going to promise to the American people that he will listen to her advice, which he probably should have listened to all along. And speaking of apologies, you know, I have been wondering, everybody's asking that question, right? When will he apologize? When will he apologize? And I've been wondering when Kenneth Starr will apologize for spending so much of our tax dollars. And I figured out that with the money he spent, we could have
hired... $40 million, right?
A little more than that at this point. We could have hired more than 1,250 teachers. We could have taken 2,500,000 people out to dinner, and that's probably where a lot of the money went. And 4,166,166 people could have come to see a show of mine, which is even more important, obviously. So I don't know when he's going to apologize at all.
An abuse of public monies. On one other topic that has been of big concern, increasingly getting attention this last week, has been the use of secret evidence, in this case in the grand jury, to sort of manipulate people into into perjury, really. This is something that's been used against artists for years, artists being constantly accused of saying things, doing things, without much evidence ever brought into the scene. How are you as an artist responding to this particular use of investigators and this kind of prosecution?
Secret evidence, and I think it's very important to start looking at patterns, right? I mean, one thing I would say is that I think there might be some new information about the leaks from the special prosecutor's office. And unfortunately, those leaks don't have traces of DNA, which is a problem for everybody. I decided to go look up some of Monica Lewinsky's history. And it's scary that most Americans know who Monica Lewinsky is. They don't remember Jocelyn Elders. But I went and looked up her mother's book, who claimed to have secret information about the private lives of the three tenors. And I read the whole thing, and I was so disappointed that I had to pay for it, because I feel like we've paid for it in so many ways. And I did find, I was snooping through to find some kind of family pattern. Maybe Monica Lewinsky got some ideas from her mother's book. And sure enough, on page 226, there is mention of a midnight blue dress. Hello. Where did she get her ideas? and of a Gen Xer having an affair with Pavarotti, who was tough and hard to please and always spoke her mind.
So DNA might be stronger than sense.
Than what?
Than sense.
I suppose.
Judith Sloan's been with us here on Democracy Now! She's a comedian and a performer. She's currently performing around the state of Maine. My name is Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. Now, our next topic is driving while black. In April of 1997, Aaron Campbell, an off-duty Florida police officer, was pulled over for allegedly failing to signal when he changed lanes. Campbell, who's African-American, argued with white police officers whom he felt were hassling him because of his race. An argument ensued, and Campbell wound up on the ground with pepper spray in his eyes and a gun pointed at his head. He was arrested and charged with assault, resisting arrest, and other violations. He was ultimately convicted on a lesser charge and sentenced to 1 year probation, but last week, Campbell filed a federal civil rights lawsuit. We have Aaron Campbell, who is a major in the Miami-Dade Metro Police Department, with us on the line from Florida. Aaron, your situation is a specific one. Your problem is not. Scores of African-American males, including prominent athletes, members of Congress, actors, and business leaders, all have experienced the humiliation of being stopped on the nation's roads for no other reason than apparently being what's called driving while black. Tell us first what happened to you that day back in April of last year. Aaron Campbell.
Well, I think for most of your listening audience who saw the video, it was pretty much obvious what occurred. What a lot of people didn't understand was the level of my anger. And my anger was really based upon the way that I was being treated, particularly with my knowledge as a law enforcement officer. I knew what they were doing to me.
When you talked about the video, you're referring to footage that many people probably saw on the news back in April and earlier this year, when by chance this whole incident was documented. Now, who was taping and why? Why do we have that footage?
That was the deputy himself. He had a camera mounted inside of his vehicle. Unknown to me, it was being videotaped. The reason it was released is because the sheriff's department up there was trying to embarrass me and embarrass my agency. So they released the tape the very next day. And I think they regret it because the tape turned out to be evidence for me.
Now, one of the things that does come across in the tape, and we're going to talk about a documentary that has been made that people will be able to see some of this footage for themselves that will be airing tomorrow on Court TV. One of the things that comes across in the videotape that was that your language became an issue of contention, that it's clear that there was an argument that ensued in which you played your fair part. What did go down there as far as you're concerned? You responded to the officers in a fairly forthright, shall we say, manner. How would you characterize your response, and how unusual do you think that is?
Well, I think it was inappropriate, but it was not against the law. You see, what happened was, you know, the way that I express myself is protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. The fact that they didn't like the fact that I used profanity was not against the law. So what they did was punish me by using the criminal justice system before my behavior. My behavior in no way was not against the law.
We're going to talk now with, we're joined in the studio by Bob Wiener, who is the producer of a documentary for Court TV about this incident and others. It's titled Driving While Black. Bob, was this documentary that's airing tomorrow on Court TV, was this inspired by Campbell's story alone?
The point of departure in all of our documentaries, which are called trial stories, is a specific case that's been fought out in the courts. What interested us in this, particularly Helen Lucatus, the reporter, and myself, was the fact that there's such a disparity in this country between black and white perceptions of what can happen, or the black experience while driving on any major roadway in this country, it seems to be, is very, very different from what most white folks experience. We went into the black community and the white community in Orlando, Florida, where this happened, and Helen was interviewing people. You talk to the white folks, and they say, oh, the police are just very polite to us, and if I got a ticket, I deserved it, and they never give me any trouble. Almost to a person, the black people, the people of color, say quite the opposite. The guy was rude. He only stopped me because I was black, because I had dreadlocks. In one case, there was a white woman who said, I'm married to a black man, and when the cops see us together, they hassle both of us. And I just wanted to bring to people's attention that we in the white society don't necessarily experience the same kind of treatment. And since we sometimes dismiss it as, oh, they're just complaining about racism and it's not justified. Well, all too often it does seem to be justified. In this case is one example of it.
Well, there have been studies of this, and one of the more recent was a study of the I-95 corridor in Maryland in 1995. Black drivers then were only 14% of the drivers on the interstate, but they represented 73% of those stopped and searched. And even more recently, John Lambers, who was a statistician with the psychology department at Temple University, studied that same track and concluded that African Americans were 4.8 times more likely to be stopped than non-blacks, and blacks were 16.5 times more likely to be arrested than whites. Aaron Campbell, in light of what happened to you, the publicity that you got, you are now bringing a lawsuit. What do you hope to get from that lawsuit, and what are you, what points are you trying to make here, both rhetorically as well as legally?
Well, I think that this situation that's occurring on the highways here in Florida and other places needs to be exposed. You know, that's one of my primary objectives. And then secondly, to sort of recoup the, I guess, I lost about $120,000 in legal expenses and court expenses, so I'm trying to recover that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit of this documentary. We have an excerpt from the Court TV documentary. The tape is of the exchange between the officers and Campbell. As Campbell just pointed out, they had a video camera mounted on the cruiser, and you'll hear the voice of the reporter, Helen, what was her second?
Lucatus.
Lucatus, who was the reporter on the story, as Bob Wiener said. Here's a cut from Driving While Black. It airs tomorrow night.
I got out of the truck, and I walked back, and he said, stand in front of my car. So I stood in front of his car, and so while I'm getting my license out, I said, what did you stop me for, man? And you can see I'm smiling. You failed to signal a lane change back there. That's all he said. Now, I knew that to be a lie, and I knew that it was not against the law. But that's when I started to use the words.
I obey the law, and I don't want you with me.
Why use that kind of language?
You know what? I grew up where I grew up at. We talk like that when we are angry with each other.
For many people, that traffic stop may have seemed routine. But for Campbell, it touched off a deep outrage that tinged his speech with obscenity.
See, I was a cop with 27 years of experience, and I also was a black male, a citizen who was being mistreated. My rights were being violated.
Within a few minutes, the roadside confrontation escalated from the verbal to the violent, and it might have cost Aaron Campbell his life.
Hey, do you have a gun on you, sir?
Yeah, I got a gun on me.
Where's that?
Right here.
Let me see your ID.
Stung by the sarcasm, Campbell grew angrier.
Even though this guy knew I was a cop, he was still treating me like I was a drug dealer, and that was not right. That troubled me.
Step back here, please.
And the major felt even more troubled after Corporal Mankiewicz shined his flashlight on the van's rear license plate.
See the bottom of your tag, too? The county's block? That's also against the law. You didn't know that.
Not against the law?
Why don't you look up the Florida statute when you get home? You can find out for yourself.
That got me even more upset because now he knew I was a cop.
That was Aaron Campbell, a major in the Miami-Dade Metro Police Department, who's with us on the line, being stopped by Florida police in April of 1997. He wound up on the ground, as we said, with pepper spray in his eyes and a gun pointed at his head, and charged with assault, resisting arrest, and other violations. We have with us in the studio Bob Wiener, who's the producer of the documentary, the clip from which you just heard. It's going to air tomorrow on Court TV, tomorrow Tuesday. It's called Driving While Black. You talked a little, Bob, about the purpose of the program being to investigate the distinction in the experiences that white people have and black people when it comes to this kind of an incident. Clearly, television is a medium that can well investigate realities different from those of the viewer and can do that job very well, particularly when it comes to race. We've seen some very interesting examples of ABC television and others sending out teams of white and black people to investigate how much racism is out there when it comes to renting a house or getting a job or finding a place for a kid to go to school. How did you go about this, and did you do anything like comparative testing with white groups driving down the highway?
We didn't even have the money or the resources or the time to do all that. So a lot of it, we researched from other areas. We took cases from other parts of the country, New Jersey, Maryland. There's an incident in Michigan. We found them in a number of places. The interesting, maybe the most interesting story aside from Aaron Campbell's, is in Maryland. It's a guy named Robert Wilkins, who's a public defender in D.C. is driving through suburban Maryland on I-95 at something like 5 in the morning with his family. They're coming back from a funeral. They're pulled over. The cops want the car searched. He doesn't want to take all the stuff out in the rain. He also is a lawyer, Harvard-trained lawyer, who says, there's no probable cause to search my car. And they just kept him there for hours. And finally, he filed suit and won. And he won a consent decree from Maryland, saying that they will keep tabs. The state police are supposed to present like monthly or quarterly reports to the Maryland ACLU on the numbers of stops and searches and the percentage of which are, it's not just blacks, it's people of color, and that's how we got those figures. Interestingly, what they did there, the ACLU in Maryland took out ads, public service announcements on a number of the urban-oriented radio stations saying, if you believe you've been stopped unwarrantedly by law enforcement in the state, call us. You may be entitled to some money. We're filing a class action suit. So since the Wilkins case, they filed a class action suit, and they're trying to get in touch with even more victims or alleged victims and see. I mean, it's interesting also that the police have something to say about this. The police say, look, we're not targeting people by race. We're looking for drug dealers. Heavy-duty interstate shipments of drugs are coming up these highways. And it sometimes maybe it's black folks in late-model cars that fit the profile. Maybe something Aaron
could address.
Just
happened to be their
profile. Just happened to. When I always say, well, if that's the case, and I was a heavy-duty drug dealer with a major distribution network, I'd hire 3 white kids and a dented Chevy.
What's happening?
That's what I was going to say. When it comes to profiling, we see it at airports, we see it on the highways. What is your response to this increasing trend when it comes to the rights of police to stop on suspicion?
You're asking
Yeah,
me?
Aaron Campbell.
Yeah, my problem is that, personally, I think the Supreme Court made a serious error in that Supreme Court decision when they allowed police to do that, because effectively what they have done is made the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution null and void.
Mm-hmm.
If you're driving in a motor vehicle, you have no rights. You have absolutely no rights at all based on the Wren versus U.S. Supreme Court decision. They can search your car anytime they want to, and that's unconstitutional.
Now, given the kind of statistics that both you and Bob Wiener have unearthed, and others too, there is legislation pending from Congressman John Conyers' office that would require police departments to maintain records exactly of who it is that they stop with respect to race, ethnicity, and gender, and so on. Given this kind of data, in an era where the language of the debate around affirmative action and other topics continues to assert that racism is a phenomenon of the past, how can you break out of the categories into which your story is put. We hear about Driving While Black in an almost insulated capsule outside of this ongoing debate about the state of racism in this country. What can people do to try to take your story and the documentary they're going to see tomorrow and make people accountable as they continue this rhetoric of why we no longer need affirmative action or whatever it is, because racism is a thing of the past? Aaron Campbell.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult, you know, considering, you know, how it is in this country. I guess that's the best way I can put it. This situation does not impact certain people. It only impacts African Americans for the most part. So,
unless, as you're saying, and both you and Bob are pointing out, that the police are using misguided profiles
exactly
in their jobs of supposedly protecting all of us.
Exactly. What they're doing is the problem is that you have, when you give that kind of power to single individual police officers, that is just too much power for them to have. You know, and I think that it's a serious error. It's something that's not compared to, say, like the Miranda decision, when the court was concerned about people's right as opposed to, you know, law enforcement. Now it's reversed. The Supreme Court seems to be more concerned about police officers' practices and procedures than they are people's individual rights. That concerns me.
What have you got to say about that, Bob? How can this story, which even in its title, Driving While Black, seems to only concern black people, become a concern for more?
Well, I think one thing that it's working on this and made me conscious of is when I drive now, I look at, whenever I see a cop car at the side of the highway, I look to see who's being stopped. And it's very interesting. I mean, what the ACLU did in Maryland may be something that they ought to consider doing other places, which is put those ads on the stations, say, have you been a victim? Maybe starting more class action suits. That's one possibility. It is interesting to me that most people, when they're stopped, I think regardless of race, creed, color, any of that, I mean, it's a very scary experience. And even if all you're afraid of getting is a couple more points on your driver's license or a $50 speeding ticket, you're being confronted with usually a man with a gun, with a power of arrest, with a very arbitrary set of things that they can use, and it becomes a lot of, yes, sir, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean it. I'm sorry. I was late for something. I didn't know. My speedometer. Whatever you say to them, and I mean, we were riding with some of these cops in Orange County, Florida, which is Orlando, the heart world of Disney World and Universal City, and millions of tourists go by there. And I mean, people of all colors are being stopped around there, and I was with one cop, and I'm watching. He's making people that he was suspecting of any form of intoxication stand there on one leg and count to 50. And I'm saying that's not right. I mean, I tried to do it, and I was impaired by nothing other than my own imbalances. And I said to him, I can't do it. I got up to about 22 and started falling over. I said, can you do it, officer? And he could. And he's been trolled to do this in court. I said, but people are nervous, even if they have had nothing else, nothing that they've imbibed, nothing, and still they have to perform for the police at the risk of being jailed for something. I don't know. I said, well, that's our standard here.
Tell us a little bit about the process of making this documentary for Court TV. Any stories involved there?
Well, there was one funny thing. I was with Helen, and we were separated. She was with Helen Lucatus, who's the reporter. She's with the camera crew, and another set of officers, and they're shooting the point. We went to the point on the Florida Turnpike where the officer Mankiewicz had been sitting, waiting for Aaron Campbell to come by. So it seemed just watching traffic there. I was somewhere else, and we were going to link up. And I'm there with this other cop, and he's got his camera on the dashboard of his car, and he's got a wireless mic on his body, and he tells me, we're going to pull somebody over. You sit in the cop car until I tell you to come out, because you never know if they're going to come out with guns blazing. We don't want you hurt. Okay, so I'm sitting there in the passenger seat of the cop car. He stops a middle-aged white guy in a rental car, gets the guy out of the car, says, where are you going? Some little town. How long are you going to be there? About a week. What is your purpose there? Well, I'm going fishing. Do you have any narcotics on you? No. do you have any alcohol on you? No. Then he goes, canine, canine. And 10 seconds later, it seemed, another cop car pulls up with a dog. So the canine officer's got the dog walking around this rental car, and nothing's happening. He comes back to where I am, and I'm standing right outside the cop car, and I say to the canine officer, well, what is your dog trained to sniff out? And he says, just three things, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. And at that point, the dog is running to the back of the cop car and going, like he's ready to bite open the trunk. And I'm saying, okay, well, what's going on in there?
That's Bob Wiener. He's the producer of a documentary for Court TV titled Driving While Black. It airs tomorrow night. It is an investigation of the kind of injustice that apparently continues to go on, where African Americans way outnumber both their proportion on the highways and every other ethnic group in arrests and detentions, not just to mention stoppages on interstates and highways of other kinds. Again, Driving While Black will be on Court TV tomorrow night. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay tuned. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. Well, today's topic, you could say, the overarching topic of today, August 17th, the day of the testimony by the president. The topics, funnily enough, are connected, I think, and the two we've been discussing today. When we talk about bullying, when we talk about secret evidence, when we talk about personal rights in light of a judicial proceeding that could be bullying one into perjuring oneself, making statements one might regret or get other people in trouble, the whole use of a grand jury and the secret evidence there is something certainly the presidents may be going through for the first time, but it is not a procedure or an experience limited to those in high executive office. One person that knows a lot about how regular folks try to maintain their rights against this kind of judicial tactic and others is Van Jones, who is the National Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in San Francisco. He has been trying for years to document cases of police brutality and establish a database on problem areas. He also works with young people, explaining what to do if they're confronted by police. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Van.
Thank you very much.
It's kind of a broad connection, but I'm going to ask you to make it. When we talk about individual rights, human rights, confrontations with police in the light of today, this big topic, the big focus on secret evidence, how do you make a connection? Do you see one there, a continuum, whether we're talking about the president or the people with whom you work on the streets with?
Well, there certainly is, and what we're seeing more and more is an increase of police authority in the lives of ordinary people. One of the things that's been occurring, and we've been screaming about this here in California, has been the increased police power that the state legislature has been granting police officers. They have more and more authority now and less accountability for what they do. And, obviously if the president is suffering, you know what people in the neighborhoods are going through.
Your work has been in part to confront police brutality, but also to educate people about their rights. And sticking with this parallel with the president for just one moment, one big topic that some people have been asking is, one big question is, why wouldn't the president just not testify? Why wouldn't he just say, I take the fifth, I'm not going to talk about this, send me to jail if you want to, like so many people have gone for refusing to testify to the grand jury. What about people's Fifth Amendment and other rights not to incriminate themselves when they're in a threatening, intimidating situation like the one we've been talking about with respect to people being stopped on the highway in a scary situation with police?
Well, one of the things that's interesting in this country is that fully half of the Bill of Rights is designed to constrain police abuse of authority. The First Amendment talks about the freedom to peacefully assemble and express oneself, not to be interfered by the police. The Fifth Amendment, obviously, no unlawful search and seizure. Don't have to incriminate yourself. The Eighth Amendment, you know, says no cruel and unusual punishment, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very, very fascinating document.
But it wasn't written to cover people of color, of course.
Well, I'm just trying to make the point that you have a constitutional democracy, so-called, where fully half of the Bill of Rights expresses this incredible concern about the police. And yet, now, whatever, 200 years later, the police are literally running rampant. We get 10 phone calls a day here in Northern California from people describing daily harassment in violation of the First Amendment, being frisked for no reason in violation of the Fifth Amendment, being beaten on the streets and beaten in the jails in violation of the Eighth Amendment, and no one's saying very much about this. And so, our concern, obviously, is that whatever one thinks about the origins of this so-called Great Republic, even people who believe in it have to be concerned at this point that the basic founding documents of United States democracy are being wholesale disregarded by district attorneys and police officers and prison guards from coast to coast.
Let me come back to Aaron Campbell for 1 minute. That's Van Jones joining us from San Francisco. Aaron Campbell is still with us on the line from Florida. He's the off-duty police officer who was pulled over for allegedly failing to signal back in April of 97 and ended up arrested and charged with resisting arrest and assault and so on. Aaron, on this topic of an individual's right to self-protection, as it were. You, as a police officer this time, but also one with the experience that you've had, what would you advise people found in the finding themselves in the situation that you were in?
Well, you know what? I wouldn't advise anyone to do exactly what I did. And I was talking specifically about the profane language. I would suggest that in circumstances like mine, that a individual would try to maintain some sort of composure. You should still stand up for your rights, but you don't have to say anything to a police officer other than your name and your address and present some ID. But you have the right to remain silent. When they start asking you questions related to this profiling process that they're doing, you really don't have to answer any questions at all.
I think that's very true, and one of the things
that
happens to people repeatedly is your first instinct, especially if you haven't done anything wrong, is to try to talk your way out of it. And in the 7 years I've been doing this work, I've never found a single person who's been able to successfully talk their way out of any of these situations who managed to talk themselves into more trouble.
Exactly.
And so as counterintuitive as it is, saying less is actually helping yourself much more than trying to get into long explanations about where you're going and who you are and what you're up to and why it doesn't make any sense for you to be stopped, et cetera, et cetera. Often the best thing to do is very respectfully, in a very cool, calm way, say your name, say your address, and then say simply, I'm not doing anything wrong. I don't consent to any search at all.
Exactly.
And see what's going to happen. If they have a mad dog intention of arresting you or holding you, detaining you, that's going to happen, and you're giving them more and more information is only going to give them more excuses to harass you further.
Hmm. We're joined by one other guest on the line I'd like to just bring into the conversation. His name is Roger Van. He's the president of the NAACP chapters in Hartford and New Haven, both in Connecticut. He's trying to document cases like Campbell's where African-Americans are pulled over for no apparent reason other than their race. Roger Van, welcome to Democracy Now! What has your research shown so far? What have you been able to document by way of a pattern?
Well, our program called Operation Blind Justice began at the beginning of last year, where when we received a number of complaints in our branches across the state on this issue of racially targeted traffic stops. And we decided to put together a program to monitor on a voluntary basis these stops across the state. And we've enlisted about 350 people in the program over the last year, and we found that there are certain communities and certain specific officers throughout the state that are particularly egregious in the violation of the rights of African American motorists. And we're very successful this past summer in getting a national resolution passed at our national convention of the NAACP to create a nationwide database that we're in the process of developing.
Tell us a little bit more about who's participating. Is it just NAACP members, or who have you got participating in this documentation project, Operation Blind Justice?
Well, no, it's not just NAACP members. What we did was that we put out a call throughout the state for participation, and we've enlisted the support and participation of African Americans, Latinos, and whites. And we're working in conjunction with a department at Yale University to do an extensive study of the data that we are receiving and comparing the experiences of blacks and Latinos and whites, people who live in the cities, live in the suburbs, work in the suburbs, work in the cities. And it's going to be a pretty extensive study that we plan to at least have a preliminary report out by the end of this year.
And Van Jones, on the other side of the country in San Francisco, you too are involved in a documentation project. Tell me a little bit about who's involved, how it works, and what kind of input are you getting and from whom?
Our project is called the Bay Area Police Watch Project, and we just recently started a New York City Police Watch Project. Basically, the idea is that anyone can call our number, 415-543-9444, and report police brutality or their experiences of police misconduct. We created a computerized database where their information can be directly put into the computer. That gives us the ability, with the click of a mouse, to be able to, over a period of time, tell you problem precincts, problem officers, problem practices, and then to give the community that information so they can really go after the trouble spots and the troublemakers within these police departments and within these police precincts. It's been very, very effective, and one of the things that we have realized is that though the federal government tracks everything from literally the size of snails in Texas, they do not keep records of police brutality at all. And so it's really important for organizations like the NAACP and like the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights to do this work ourselves. The information that we have been able to gather is shocking. We have more than 2,000 reports now. We've been up for about 2 years, and some of the stories would really curl your hair.
Hmm. Aaron Campbell, before we say goodbye to you, I'd like you just to give us some sense of what kind of a reaction your story has met with so far. There'll be a documentary airing tomorrow on Court TV. It's likely to get more attention, but what's been the reaction so far? What kind of support have you found? And what about the reaction by cops of color, you might call them, inside the police force to what happened to you, Aaron Campbell?
Well, you know, I have received just about universal support. I mean, not just here in South Florida, but throughout the southeastern part of the United States, as well on the east coast of this nation. I've gotten telephone calls, letters, cards, financial support, you know, email to my department. I've got tremendous and universal support from all ethnicities regarding what happened to me. I think.
But is there anything changing, like inside the police departments that you know? Are they going to change anything as far as the maintaining of records and the kinds of problems that Van Jones and Roger Van just outlined?
No, and I want to comment on that. Even with I commend them for the effort, but the fact this, and I'm saying this as an insider, as a police officer, I don't think it's going to change anything until it starts impacting white people. And I don't think it's going to change because the politicians are the ones who are pushing this. They are reinforcing this behavior on the part of certain police officers. So it's not going to change. I'm telling you, it will not change until there are some sanctions, until some officers are charged criminally. The Justice Department is not even concerned about it. When that changed, then there would be a difference.
I couldn't agree with that more.
Van Jones.
one of the big problems that has been documented now by Human Rights Watch, which is an international human rights organization that decided to turn its attention this year to the United States and produced just a bombshell report about police violence inside the United States, unlawful police violence here. One of the things that they said is that time after time after time, the local district attorneys, the federal Department of Justice, refuse to charge police officers for violating the law. And it emboldens police officers, you know, to violate human rights and individual rights up to the point of death and murder. We have a 17-year-old white girl here in San Francisco, California, liberal San Francisco, who was shot in the head and killed by a notorious thug police officer named Gregory Breslin 3 months ago. This was an unarmed girl in a car with two other youth. Plainclothes police officers jumped out, pulled their guns out, told the kids to stop. The kids thought it was a carjacking, tried to drive away. The cops opened fire and killed an unarmed girl. The district attorney is saying it was justifiable. This happens over and over again in city after city, town after town, and it really does create an environment of impunity where law enforcement feels like it does not have to obey the laws that it enforces. And that is a dangerous situation for everyone. I have to say that any day, 20 to 30% of the people who are calling us now are white people. This problem is beginning to affect the entire country.
Roger Van, was that you commenting, agreeing that there
I would say in that there's a great deal of potential for coalition building. And what we've discovered is that those police departments and those specific officers that are predisposed to violate the rights of people of color may also be predisposed to violate the rights of anyone without regard to race. And I think that's the kind of message that we need to get out to folks in other communities so that we can build a broad-based coalition to fight this. Because I agree that unless we have some white faces around the table and some white victims and so forth, it's going to be all that more difficult to get national legislation passed and get national policy and state and local policy changed as well.
Well, it's 55 minutes past the hour, and we've got another 3 or 4 minutes only left in the program. I'd like to let Aaron Campbell go. Thank you very much for being with us here on the show. Before we end, I'd like to ask you, Van Jones, we started the program with talking about the implications of the president's situation for the population, for politics in this country. And there's been increasing talk over the last few weeks about people's alienation, apathy, so on and so forth. And yet hearing you and hearing Roger Van, I'm hearing that there is a lot of activism going on around this issue of police brutality, driving while black, the racially targeted traffic stops. What do you make of the kind of political activity that you see around these issues? Isn't this politics in the USA? I'll start with you, Van Jones.
Well, I have to agree with Roger Van that the question of the expansion of police authority and the abuse of police authority is something that's beginning to affect more people. And it truly has the potential to be a rainbow issue that really brings together people who have never come together before. We're seeing that in Northern California, seeing that in New York City, as Latinos, white, gay, and lesbian organizations, African-American groups and youth groups all come together to try to figure out what to do. The three courses of action that seem to be taking, going right now are, one, know your rights activities, letting people know what their rights really are. Two, trying to win reforms to strengthen civilian review. And three, are, you know, direct observation, oversight, and monitoring activity by independent community groups.
Last word from you, Roger Van.
I would ditto everything there, and I think that we do need to stress the political side of this. It's a statewide election year here in the state of Connecticut. What we're trying to do through our NAACP branches and organizations that are working in coalition with us is impressing upon those people who are looking to us for our support politically that they need to support us on these and other issues that are very important to us as a community.
How do they reach you, Roger Van, in Connecticut, if they want to take part in your Operation Blind Justice program?
Area code 203-776-2662 or through email gnhnaacp@snet.net.
The phone number again is 203-776-2662.
Correct.
I believe the number that you gave earlier, Van Jones, correct me if I'm wrong, was 415-543-9444.
That's right.
I'd like to thank you both very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! Roger Van in Hartford and New Haven, Connecticut, in Connecticut, shall we say, today. Van Jones in San Francisco with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. My name is Laura Flanders. I'm sitting in for Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, you can call the following number. It's 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also reach us via email. Our address is democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders.